Good afternoon. Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you today?
I am happy to be here. I'm a little off. Maybe my Mercury is in retrograde or something.
Okay.
I have no idea what that means. But there is a big full moon coming upon us this week, though.
It's like a blood moon or something?
Blood moon. Yeah. And it's supposed to be the longest full lunar eclipse in history, but we're not going to see any of it.
Okay. I saw that. Yeah.
But the energy apparently must be all around us, because I left my house twice today to come here and had to turn around and go back, because I'd forgotten things, which isn't normally like me. And so I'm feeling just a little off step in some ways. But I'm ready for today's conversation, because as always, it's a group of different things that have kind of fallen together to create today's topic. So I'll be curious to know how this resonates for you, and you know, what kind of calls it might stimulate. But let me start off with some of the reasons I'm in this place, and not that I'm why I'm discombobulated, that's just life, but why I'm in this place for today's show, because I watched a movie that came out, I think last year, written by Aaron Sorkin, called Molly's Game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know if you saw that movie.
With Jessica Chastain?
Yeah, Jessica Chastain, and she plays Molly Bloom. I thought it was a great movie. I enjoy Aaron Sorkin's style of writing. He writes as quickly as I talk, so I enjoy that. But it was an interesting story about Molly Bloom, because here is this young woman who was a premier athlete, had been, you know, pushed really hard by her father, and had, you know, was a Olympic skier, or on the path to be an Olympic skier, and things just kind of change. But what happens is, she, you know, even though her life changes, the intensity, the drive that pushes her keeps driving her in other aspects of her life outside of her athletic prowess. And ultimately, when I was looking back over the movie, I don't want to give anything away, but when I was looking back over it, I wanted to be her therapist, because there was such a correlation between this message she received from a young age that she needed to be perfect all the time, and needed to push herself, and needed to achieve at high levels. And there was this kind of underlying sense that if she did not do these things, she would be unlovable, or therefore rejected by her father. And so that kind of carried into her life. Now, I might have read way more into the movie, but the therapist in me couldn't help it. And so I was kind of carrying the idea of that movie. And then I was listening through audio from some of the interviews I've done with artists over the last couple of years. And I came across a conversation I had with Liz Beebe, who is the lead singer for Dust Bowl Revival. And she's a beautiful young woman. And we had a great conversation, kind of went all over the place. But what I found interesting about that conversation, listening back to the audio, was that although we started off kind of chatting about her path to being, you know, part of this band, and her professional achievements, our conversation quickly kind of changed and morphed into a conversation about self-care and self-acceptance, and the drive and the push, and then that sense of needing to always be perfect, and needing to always be bettering ourselves, and needing to always be achieving some level of perfection. And so that kind of dovetailed into my experience with the movie Molly's Game. And then I was having a conversation with my friend Lucia Capaccioni. She's a wise elder in my life. And we were talking about self-acceptance and self-love. And like the majority of women in culture, I struggle with kind of this dance between self-acceptance, loving myself as I am, and this drive towards, but I could be better. But I should be trying harder. I should be, you know, always trying to achieve whatever that next level is. And then getting caught up in that dance of my body. And I wish in some ways that it was a dance, that it was a beautiful tango that my psyche and my body do. But it's more of a tug of war, it seems like, for control, or even just a battle between myself and my body, which seems to do whatever it wants to do, and me who's trying to make it be what I want it to be. And even at, you know, 57, I would think I should have outgrown this by now. And I look at my wise elders and think, when is that point when I just kind of just go with a caftan? I don't know how else to say it, you know, to just let myself be and appreciate those other things. But I don't think I'm there yet. And I think that the message from our culture that if women don't stay competitive or continue to be shapely in some way or attractive in some way, we become invisible. And once we become invisible, then our ability to advocate for change or bring about things that we care deeply about become more difficult because we lose our cultural validity. You know, we become invalidated. And so my conversation with her led to this idea that, you know, really, when we talk about women's liberation, and I'm using liberation on purpose, when we talk about women's liberation, this 170-year march towards freedoms and equality, she and I both talked about the idea that, you know, the liberation really is in many ways more than just liberation from the drudgery of being the primary caregiver or doing the housework, although I loved that job, but feeling that that was the primary purpose of women. Even more so than the liberation from poor pay or sexual misconduct, our true liberation as women will be from the tyranny of self-loathing. That it's really self-loathing that is the driving force that keeps women even more entangled in the struggle, a struggle, than anything else. Because if we had full body acceptance, full self-love, full appreciation for what we are capable of as women, I think the battles that we would fight for equality would be less of a hurdle because we would have the power and conviction of self-love and self-affirmation. But because as women we are put in a place where we're told from a young age that our ability to be loved, our worthiness, is subject to how we look and how we behave and how we act, it makes it challenging for women to overcome those expectations and make bigger statements because we're bogged down for decades just trying to feel worthy of someone's love and attention, whether it's a parent or a partner, and then ultimately ourselves. And this position of self-loathing is so common in women that the American Psychological Association has deemed it a normative discontent, which means it is so common we don't consider it a disorder of any kind. That it's so common for women to feel depressed about their body, to have self-loathing, to feel ashamed of who they are, that that is the normal, and that young women or women in general who feel good about themselves would be considered abnormal on that spectrum. And until we can shift that, I think it's going to be very challenging for women to really fully ever reach a sense of liberation that's longstanding. And so today's conversation for me is about this idea of chasing perfection of self. And what does self-love look like? Because when we talk about self-love, people will quickly say, well, that's just self-absorption. Anyone who's that into themselves and is that caring of how they look and spending that much time at the gym or that much time at the beauty salon or that much time, you know, having Botox or these, that's just self-absorption. That's not self-love. And so even within the conversation of how do we best care for ourselves, there's a lot of shaming and finger pointing and misunderstanding about what that self-love actually looks like. And if we understood what it was to truly accept ourselves, does that mean that we just let ourselves go? We go full caftan? Or does that mean that we are fully engaged in the process of bettering ourselves on every front, whether it's our physicality, our intellectual abilities, and our emotional state? And then the idea of is it possible to get all three of those things in some sort of balance, which really is what self-love looks like, is the balance of those things we value and living those values. But we tend to get caught up in one area of our life and we focus on it so heavily, for example, body image, body size, that it takes away from other areas of our life where we could have pleasure and strong relationships. So I want to explore that a little bit today. I want to talk about how you feel about yourself. Is this just my story? According to the American Psychological Association, no, it's not. But how do we feel about ourselves? And how can we, as women and as men, find a healthy way to care for ourselves, to find the sense of self-love, but at the same time, find a level of self-assurance that we can go out and make a difference in the world? You know, the thought is, if we spent as much time chasing the battles in the world that mattered to us as we did fighting the battles within ourselves, how much more could we get done? This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. You can find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can check out our newly updated website, thereluctanttherapist.com. And as always, send me an email to Elizabeth at The Reluctant Therapist. Also, if you'd like to podcast our shows, you can check us out on Apple Podcasts or NPR One, and you can listen to all of our previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. So think about that body, and we'll take a moment and come back and take your calls. I could have loved you if you let me. I could have loved you, but you left me. I tried to love you, baby, but you left me hanging high and dry. That is the powerful vocals of Liz Beebe of Dust Bowl Revival. Isn't her voice just incredible?
It really is.
Yeah, she's...
I was just also going to say, you know, you had me thinking ever since she's been talking about caftans. And yeah. If you and I, you want to do the show, you and me and caftans together every week, I'm totally fine with that.
Okay, good. Good. Well, I'll go through my closet and see if I have something hidden in the back there.
I have a few.
Okay, good. You can bring one for me. Yes, Liz Beebe is a powerhouse. She's great to spend time with, and she's even more fun to see on stage. She's got a lot of range. She has so much personality. The whole band is a blast.
I had a blast at Live Oak seeing them. They were fantastic.
They are so much fun. And it's interesting because today they were posting, they're at Spotify's main offices in New York City visiting. And so it looks like their music's just taking off. So I feel honored to have had spent time with the band on many occasions. But this conversation I want to share with you, we're going to listen a bit to my conversation with Liz Beebe from last year at Whale Rock. Having this conversation. And as I said, it starts off just kind of, hey, tell me how you got started in the business. And then it kind of wound around to this whole kind of struggle of what it is to be a woman in the world and how to be our best selves and try to keep it all going and how exhausting it all is. So, let's listen to a little bit of that conversation with Liz Beebe from Dust Bowl Revival. I first want to know, what drew you into music? How did you start this path towards being on the road and sharing your gift?
Well, I have sung my whole life, and I joined Dust Bowl about 3.5 years ago. It's kind of a funny story. I was working in television production for about 7 years while working as an actor in Los Angeles. I actually went to college for theater.
Where did you go?
Mary Washington University, although when I was there it was called Mary Washington College. They upgraded after I graduated. But they have a great theater program, and I really felt prepared to go to LA and have a good foundation in terms of auditioning and how to actually get work. But I had sung my whole life and did a lot of chorus and musical theater and, you know, just singing for fun and all that. And I was working in television production, and was really trying to ask myself, like, why am I having such a hard time in this community of work that I really love and I think is really fun and I should be excited about? I was feeling a lot of stress and just sort of like unevenness in my emotional life. And I asked myself, you know, what I really like. And I said, I think I really like to sing more. And so I told my husband, who was actually in a band at that time, I want to be in a band. And he was like, okay, like, I've been doing it for 9 years. Fine, just join a band. And so I started, you know, I did the Artist's Way and was really just trying to open myself up creatively to possibilities that maybe I was shutting down subconsciously. And just was like Googling session singing work in LA, hoping to just sing for fun as like backups on someone's album or jingles or whatever, just to sort of be doing more of that in my life. And the second link I clicked on was Dust Bowl looking for a new lady lead singer. Because Caitlin, who was the former lead singer, left about 4 months before I joined to be in Smoothhound Smith, which is a duo out of Nashville now. And it was right when Dust Bowl was starting to tour, and we just sort of have been on the road ever since. So,
and that was 3 years ago.
Yeah, feels a little faded to have found them that way, but
absolutely,
it's a great fit.
But isn't that the whole idea of the Artist's Way, right? You put the intention out there, mm-hmm. and the doors start opening.
Oh yeah, which is, I am constantly going back to that saying, I need to be more specific if I'm this good at manifesting what I want.
You get a little nervous about what you watch, what
you
wish
for. I was like, okay, I asked for more travel and to be doing music and not have like a specific day job. I need to be more specific the next time about what kind of travel I'm doing.
And so do you and your husband see each other ever?
Well, how does that work? We are on the road about 250 days a year. But when we are home, we perform sort of locally or, you know, up in NorCal. So I am home about 100 days a year. And so when I'm home, I really try to make sure that I'm home base focused and making sure that the time that I'm home is focused around him and like those close friendships to sort of fill me back up before I go on the road. Energetically speaking, at least.
And so you said you were kind of not feeling like you were getting what you needed emotionally, mm-hmm. in your mental health when you were doing the actor tour at LA. How have things changed for you, or have things changed since you've been touring?
Well, touring obviously presents its own challenges, just sort of physical comfort wise and like getting enough sleep and making sure you're feeding yourself the way your body needs to be fed. But creatively, I feel very full. So when I was doing television production, it was really satisfying sort of organizationally and like life purpose wise, because mm-hmm. it's sort of an ass kicking job where you work together and you do things that, you know, quote unquote, shouldn't be able to be done for the time and money you have allotted, which is great, I think, for like the Western world mentality of like how to prove that you're worth something, which definitely falls under my type A personality. But being in Dust Bowl is really creatively fulfilling. I used to seek out music as a way to release a lot of emotional tension, and now I seek out a lot of silence and quiet, which is interesting even for me to figure out. Lots of podcasts to sort of educate myself in another way while I'm on the road or reading, but I actually seek out music less now just because I get to do it so much, and I'm giving so much of that emotional person that I am on stage with just the songs that we play.
And so when we talked, you know, before we started the conversation here, we were having a conversation about taking care of our mental and physical health, and that you noticed from a young age that you, or did you know at a young age that you were highly sensitive, that you were creative, you know, because you went to college for theater. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a certain kind of person that's attracted to the performing arts. So can you talk a little bit about your journey, kind of discovering your temperament and your nature and
yeah.
and where it took you?
I'll go backwards, because I feel like now, I'm 35 now, and I feel like I'm just coming to terms with the fact that being a highly sensitive person or an empath or whatever you want to call it, is something that I've accepted as a thing that's okay to be, because I grew up having people be like, you're so sensitive, and I've been defensive my whole mm-hmm. life. Like, that's my go-to, is like proving that what I'm doing is okay or right. And sort of, and I think a lot of my friends that are in their 30s, and most of us live in California, so maybe that's a trend, but we're all sort of on this journey of like, okay, self-love, acceptance, like what I'm doing is okay, and maybe my projection of what I think I should be doing is something I need to revisit. But yeah, I mean, I've known since I was 15 that I have had food sensitivities, which has been a struggle my whole life, about quote unquote being good and feeding myself maybe what my body wants, and then wanting to eat what everyone else is eating / what tastes
to
good.
To be normal.
Whatever. Yeah, whatever. If eating McDonald's is normal, right? Like, that's
exactly
what I wanted to be doing.
Exactly.
But they have the formula down. So even though I know it's terrible for me,
it still
man,
draws
Big
you
Macs
in.
Are great. but yeah, like I also did therapy at an early age. Just, I think even when I was as young as 8, like I had talked to a, you know, like sand play and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So going back and forth to knowing that I like to talk things out, to figure them out, and that I've always received the world emotionally. And even though I'm great at sort of business and organization and I'm a type A person, I also, my language is always like, I feel this rather than I think this, just sort of naturally. So yeah, I mean, now I'm trying to accept that part of myself instead of push it away or try and correct it. But yeah, I think I knew then, but now I understand it more, if that makes sense.
Well, and it's interesting because you described, I think, which is the journey for, you know, 90% of young people, is that we have such a very narrow definition of what is normal and okay. Mm-hmm. Be a high achiever, get good grades, be a good athlete, be popular, right? Mm-hmm. It's like there's this list of almost unachievable requirements that every young person feels pressured to do. And then it's almost like you have to go through an unlearning of all the things you were told were important when you were little.
Oh, definitely.
So where were you at 15? Like, what were some of the things that you were told you needed to do to be okay? And what did you have to unlearn at 35?
Oh, that even if you do them, you're still going to feel like there are things wrong with you or that you need to change. I did all of those things. I was built for the kind of school system that we have in America. Like, oh, if you learn this and then put it on a test, like, you'll get good grades. And if you get good grades, you go to college. And if you, like, play sports, then you're a well-rounded individual. Like, I did all of those things. I played 3 sports. I did musical theater. I did, you know, regular theater. I was in chorus. I did, like, girls singing groups specifically. I mean, I wouldn't say that I was, like, popular in terms of, like, you know, Mean Girls, Queen Bee or anything. I went to a boarding school in Maine, so we were pretty hippie. But I had a lot of friends, and I did all of the things. And going to college for theater and absorbing what I needed to absorb from that and constantly being working on that craft, moving to LA and, you know, doing all of the things with the tools that you've been given and, like, making a living for yourself and finding a husband and getting married and keeping friends close to you that matter to you, you can still be 35 and be like, I've done all of the things. Like, why do I feel unsettled? Or, like, why is my gut messed up? Or, like, you know, why can't I eat normal things that other people can eat? There's always something. You're always going to be raising that bar to another level and chasing something.
And so at 15, as a high achiever, talented young lady, I imagine that your habits that you had at 15 or the things you were told you should do for your physical health, how did that impact where you are today? Because I guess kind of the conversation we're dancing around is that at 35, you're experiencing what a lot of people do at different times in their life. Oh, I need to change the way I eat so I can balance my gut.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing different today?
Yeah, well, I, of course, you know, playing sport, did all the things that you would normally do, like, you know, carb load before games and lift weights and run a lot. And when I moved to Los Angeles and was sort of, you know, 22 and eating cheddar bacon fries and drinking beer at that point in my lifestyle, I just was really swollen. So I sort of have, you know, I guess been gifted with a faster metabolism, so I'm sort of a slight of frame person, but, like, I can carry water weight like no one's business. So I was realizing that I was sort of just uncomfortable in my own body. I'm sure part of it was, like, societal pressures, but I don't even necessarily mean that. I just mean, like, physically uncomfortable. So in my early 20s, I did Weight Watchers, which at the time it was shifting their focus from you can eat a pizza and it's 7 points or whatever to, you know, eating quote-unquote healthy, like more fruits and vegetables, less processed foods and stuff. So I probably got on that train at the right time as opposed to when Weight Watchers had started. And it worked really well. Like, I lost a bunch of weight. I was eating healthier. When I went back to the way I was eating with carbohydrates and stuff, I would notice the difference. So that was probably when I started being like, oh, I'm not 22 anymore. I need to really pay attention to how food makes me feel. And I had known from, like I said earlier, an earlier age at like 15 that I had seen a new natural health doctor back in New Hampshire. And he had been like, you're allergic to dairy, quite obviously, by looking at you. So I had known.
Was it because of skin issues?
Well, just like circles under my eyes and lots of other physical symptoms. I think probably skin issues too, because I did have acne as a teenager, just like most people did. And I think that's one of my weaknesses, is if my body's out of whack, my skin is like, hello, please pay attention to me. You are 35 and you will have adult acne if you don't eat right. So I don't know. Maybe that's a blessing, but it's also super annoying. But yeah, I guess, so I was doing stuff like that, you know, really probably over-exercising in a way that isn't great for my system, because I run sort of high energy, more prone to anxiety. I probably should be focusing on more things like yoga. But when I would do yoga, it would make me really emotional. Mm-hmm. Probably a clue in the right direction, but I was like, avoid this discomfort. So over the years, I have felt considerably worse and worse and worse. So around 30, I was like so tired all the time, and I worked in a really stressful job, like television production, coupled with my need to please people and being a type A personality. It was just like, you know, a Molotov cocktail for my guts to be continually destroyed and feel super, super tired all the time and overwhelmed eventually. Even though who I worked with, I loved, you know, I'm still really good friends with those people, and I even sometimes miss the camaraderie of sort of like being in the trenches together, but music affords a bunch of that stuff as well.
I would imagine there's a lot of camaraderie in music.
Yeah, totally. So I eventually decided to just, I had done a bunch of elimination diets in the past, the specific carbohydrate diet for one, based on the Breaking the Vicious Cycle, A Guide to Intestinal Health was a book that I read in my late 20s. And I was like, these symptoms really coincide with how I'm feeling. And once I started cutting out those carbohydrates, I really felt a lot of like spontaneous joy, which was a sign to me I was sort of going in the right direction. Because I'm prone to be more sluggish and a little more melancholy if I am eating heavy carbohydrates. Heavy probiotic therapy, really like low impact, like walking, yoga, anything to keep me in my parasympathetic nervous system to just chill me out. Because stress aggravates your gut, you know, everything is really connected, and it's been really, really helpful. Getting enough sleep is really the new, I think gut has been the last 10 years of health, and of course that's going to continue, but sleep is like the new frontier. I mean, Sarah Ballantyne, the paleo mom, who's a doctor, you know, a PhD, she was a medical researcher and also has autoimmune problems. She's coming out with a lot of new information about sleep being even almost more important than diet. And, you know, Arianna Huffington just came out with a book on sleep. Like, it's definitely in the zeitgeist, so I just hope that our tour schedule will eventually allow us to actually sleep a little bit more than we are, but maybe that's wishful thinking. Just napping in the van is what I need to do.
Well, and it's funny because sometimes I wonder that when we strip all of the things that made us fun out of our lives, do we lose our, you know, the things that made us interesting when we were young?
Right.
We become like so connected to our need for our diet and our sleep.
Yeah.
That there's that trade-off.
Totally. Yeah, I worried about that. I struggled. I think that was the yo-yo back and forth about eating what I wanted to eat and eating what I knew made me feel good, because I would sort of dig my heels in and be like, but I want to go on tour or whatever, on vacation, and like eat my way through a city. But as I got older, and the more that I removed things from my diet, when I would indulge, I would feel worse. And like, I don't want to go on vacation now and have no energy or be a moody jerk to my husband because I decided to have fried chicken or french fries or whatever, pasta. So now I just eat things that make me feel good, and I do a lot of I put a lot of effort into what will make me feel good, to taste really good, make what's best for you be more fun than great, you know?
So my last question is this. Where do you find yourself at 40? Do you, you know, because you're the one about envisioning, right?
Yeah.
The intentionality. What's the intention for the next 5 years?
I would love for Dust Bowl to be touring like we have been, maybe a little bit less. We were on the road quite a bit, but it's really great being able to come to festivals like this and have sort of a minute of peace and run into other bands that we know and really get to immerse ourselves in that community, because we're with each other a lot, and that's wonderful. But it's really cool to be around other musicians and just see how they're living this lifestyle. And so maybe to just have a little bit more of a break while working would be awesome. I'd love to be at a point sort of physically where I feel like I'm at a good place in terms of like my routine is on lock, and I feel like I'm getting enough sleep, and that I just have a little bit more energy than I do right now. And selfishly, I'd love my skin to be a little clearer, but what I've heard is that I'm still releasing some toxins, and that just happens to come out of my face. So, yeah, I guess I hope I'm easier on myself, and I hope I have a little bit more of a habit of self-love and acceptance and patience than I do right now. I think right now I still struggle with my 20-year-old self to, like, be better and do more, and I'm starting to let go, but I hope that when I'm 40, I have, like, more of that patience than I have now.
So now you've put it out there in the world,
yeah.
So we'll see where it goes.
We'll see where it goes. We'll reconvene in 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Liz.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We've been talking to Liz Beebe, and we're going to come back, open the phones, and take your call.
I never met no one like you. Every word you say, it's the truth. Still waiting for you to call my bluff. Tears streaming down your face.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and that's Dust Bowl Revival. I just finished up my conversation with Liz Beebe. And so it's interesting because clearly the conversation, you know, I always am directing towards mental health and well-being and what we do to take care of ourselves. But after, you know, I was putting it together at the end when she kind of says, you know, I hope I'm kinder to myself. You know, I hope that I practice more self-love, and that's the part that really stood out for me, because I appreciate, you know, that all of us want to find and pay attention to the ways that our body responds to food and to exercise and to sleep, and that is part of that self-love piece. That really is truly self-love, that I nurture and care for my being in such a way that I feel good. I can't remember his first name, but Seligman, who is the father of positive psychology, you know, he said, true happiness is not escaping misery, but being able to be in the presence of well-being. And that for most of us, we spend a good deal of our life just trying not to feel lousy, you know, trying to minimize the level of lousiness that we feel. But true satisfaction with life is to be in the presence of well-being, to kind of find that sweet spot. And he also talks about, in the world of positive psychology, that there is a distinct difference between self-love and being self-indulgent, and that quite often we mistake self-indulgence with just being self-care, and that can throw us off. So I'm just curious to know, you know, where are you in this self-care, self-loving, or self-loathing story? Do you spend a lot of time kind of being caught up in those self-care rituals, or being judgmental of yourself, beating yourself up because of the way you look or don't look, being overly critical, or maybe feeling like you're not critical enough, kind of being in that battle between yourself and who your perfected self should be? I'd love to know your thoughts on this. 805-781-3875. It's the number to be part of the conversation today. 805-781-3875. And you have to dial in the 805 because we have grown so much now. So 805-781-3875. Now, where are you in this? And, you know, I think about as a mother as well, because I have, you know, two daughters now, a granddaughter, and my experience growing up and kind of being in this society that was constantly reminding me that I was not thin enough or smart enough or pretty enough or talented enough to be worthy of someone, you know, loving me just as I am, that there was this constant reminder that I needed to always be self-improving. And I really didn't want to pass that experience on to my girls, that I really wanted them to have a different relationship to with their body and with themselves so they could spend more time nurturing and developing gifts in other ways, gifts that they had through their intelligence, their academic curiosity, or through their emotional curiosity, or to be able to feel comfortable enough in relationships that they could bring their true self to the relationship and really start connecting with people from an authentic place. Because one of the traps of feeling like as we are is not enough to be worthy of someone else's love and attention, we tend to start altering our natural behavior to please or to be what we hope other people want us to be so that they'll accept us. And those efforts can quite often get us into relationships that don't work because you're not entering into the relationship as you truly are, or you get into the relationship with someone who really wasn't a good fit for you, but you feel like they somehow were the embodiment of someone wonderful. And so this whole critical idea of self-love and self-care really comes from this place of self-awareness and self-understanding, more so than loving ourselves into a beautiful shape or loving ourselves into clear skin or loving ourselves enough to accept others' loves. That at the essence of this conversation about self-acceptance or self-love is really embracing the wholeness of who you are. And, you know, it's surprising, Tyler, because you would think that, you know, doing research for this program, we would stick to the positive psychologists or, you know, pay attention to what the modern dietary recommendations are or read up on everything about sleep. I mean, there is a never-ending supply of information about all the ways that we could be doing better. And there is always a new shiny object that people chase that promises to bring them wholeness and happiness just if they, you know, have the right face scraping or Botox or hair extensions. I mean, it's endless. You know, the diet industry is, I want to say, $7 to $11 billion a year. It's a great business because it's a recurring business because people can't keep the weight off. So they're always kind of re-entering that. The makeup cosmetics industry is in the billions of dollars because there's always some very expensive something that we are promised is going to make us feel better. But that's all just kind of noise in the background and prevents us from paying attention to really what it is that our psyche, our soul is craving. And the best information I found about self-love really came from Aristotle. So I'm not trying to sound pretentious in any way by quoting Aristotle, but the words that I found that he shared about wholeness made the most sense. So Aristotle, I'm just going to keep saying that. According to Aristotle, embracing the wholeness of who you are is the key to self-love and self-actualization. And that starts with living according to your values. And that's not something that we talk about that often, that really paying attention to our value system much more than how we look or what we're gifted at or what our academic achievements are. But what are the things that we value? And according to Aristotle, a lot of our life work must be centered around discovering what it is that's truly important to you. Whatever that is, those things that you truly value in the world. And once you have uncovered and discovered what it is truly important to you, the next challenge is living according to those values. Because a lot of people will state things that are important to them. They'll state that these are values that they have, you know, to be kind to others, to be kind to myself, to nurture the planet, to, you know, make time for family, whatever those values are, to a strong work ethic, you know, spending time in a spiritual sense. Like, people will talk about those values that they have, but not many people actually live in accordance to the values that they state that they have. And so what happens is that when there is a disconnect between those things we state that we value and how we actually live our life, that can causes the disconnect, the discontent, the normative discontent. And that's where kind of that war with ourself becomes evident, that it's not just as trying to beat our bodies into submission through diet and exercise, but it's really this internal psychic battle that goes on between the values that we hold deeply that are in the core of who we are and the way that we live our life. And that the two of those things colliding causes this sense of worthlessness, or the sense of being an imposter, or this kind of self-hate that people get into. And self-love, according to, and I'm not saying that this is Aristotle's quote, I didn't take it from a book, because I can't imagine Aristotle standing in the middle of a square saying self-love. But self-love will start to emerge as a byproduct because of the increased positivity that we feel when we're living in accordance of our values. Seems simple enough. And have you ever really sat down and thought about what your value system is? You know, like we'll think about, I want to eat healthy and I want to have good relationships and I'd like to have a nice job, right?
I feel like I start every Monday that way.
You start every Monday.
But by the end of the week, it's changed.
Well, but also those are kind of broad. You know, I'd like a nice job and to eat well. But when you talk about like a value system, it's something even, like, what is it that you stand for?
Oh, wow. You're putting me on the spot.
No, I'm not trying to. Because in my head, I'm trying to formulate, you know, the difference between a value system and...
Well, you know,
beliefs.
Recently, I was recently around a bunch of friends and I realized what's really important to me moving forward for my value system is to surround myself with people that lift each other up, and then to also be lifting those people up. And I decided that's something I didn't figure out until I was in my 30s. And I was like, oh, I just only can surround myself by other positive influences. And so that's a big deal for me moving forward. And so that's sort of part of my value system, is to make sure I'm, you know, involved in a community that does that.
Well, because unfortunately, for whatever reason, we are as humans attracted to those things that make us feel crappy about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so there's something very seductive about the groups of people that pick at us, that are constantly, you know, reminding us of the ways we're not quite living up to whatever those expectations are. And then ironically, you know, it's things our parents told us when we were young turn out to be true. Those people that put you down the most really are just envious of who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, but you don't hear that. You just hear the criticism. And then for some reason you feel like, I'm going to surround myself with these people because now they've reminded me all the ways that I'm unworthy.
You know, living in New Orleans for so long, it's such an interesting place, but I was part of an exodus of multiple people that left there around the same time. We've all been keeping in contact with each other and supporting each other and checking in on each other. And when we see each other, and to see everyone succeeding and to make, I don't know, it was important in that leaving moment to remember we all have to be building each other up, because it just gets harder the older we get.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, at some point I feel like we just get tired of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
It gets exhausting being at war with yourself and constantly feeling like you're picking over the rubble of who you are. Mm-hmm. And then there becomes like, I'm going to hand this over now, and I'm going to allow myself to do the things that nurture me. And it's more than one area. It's not just, we tend to focus as a culture on our bodies, that is the representation of who we are and our value in the world. And believe me, I don't have this solved, because as I said at the top of the show, you know, I'm very aware that for women of a certain age, there is a sense of becoming invisible in society, because we no longer embody what the society values in women. A certain size, a certain look, you know, a certain vitality. And it's unfortunate, because as women age and gain their wisdom and their power, they have so much more even. Oh, the wrong phone is actually ringing. I had to remember to turn that off. That as women, we have, you know, that we start to have more and more to share the older we get and the more experiences we have, but the culture kind of cuts us off and says, yeah, you're invisible to us now. We have nothing more for you to say. And so I feel this tug at, I need to work harder. I need to be in better shape, or I need to do something to continue to be visible to those around me so that I can continue to offer what I think I have to offer to the world. Then ironically, of course, I feel like I have much more to offer now at 57 than I did at 27 mm-hmm. or 37, which becomes the laughable part. It's like, why are we taking our life advice from, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow or Kim Kardashian or these women who have no real life experience behind mm-hmm. them at all? And yet they're writing books and they have blogs and people Pinterest and follow them and as if they are the word of God in some way. And they really don't have much at all to offer. But then someone who's, you know, 67 or 77 or 87, who really is still engaged in life, has not fallen into a place of kind of bitterness and anger, but has continued to live and be vibrant and grow themselves, has a ton to offer. And we reject that.
We also have to look back at, you know, how you valued those things when you were 22. It's really hard to listen to those people sometimes. So I try to check myself all the time on that.
But that, of course, is just a cultural story, though. It's right. It's not that the elders mm-hmm. had less to say or to offer. It's what we were told when we were young. You know, I mean, you and I, you're younger than I am, but I was right on the cusp of that don't trust anyone over 30. You know, there was that complete shift that, you know, anyone over 30 couldn't possibly be of value. And that just kind of sent us careening down this path of revering, you know, youthful ignorance over wisdom. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there is the media pulse that starts, you know, saying, wait, you can even be better if you apply all these things. And, you know, I don't know if this is if something that we're even conscious of daily, that we're so hooked into the story that even the conversation is mute. It's like, well, you know, I'm thinking back to the story of Molly Bloom, Molly's Game, that I talked about at the top of the show. And this young woman had been so enculturated to do everything right. She was a premier athlete. She was a premier student. She was incredibly brilliant. She was going to law school on a full scholarship. I mean, just all of the things that we value in our American culture, she was that poster child of. Parents were, you know, very proud. And yet she was so riddled with demons that the pleasures of her life were almost non-existent. I mean, she drove herself into addictions and to isolation and alienation because she was driven by this need to be perfect so that she could be deemed worthy and lovable by the people that mattered to her. And so I worry that this conversation almost slides off the table because the American dream person is so enculturated in us that we can't even have the conversation. It's like, yeah, that sounds good in theory. Love yourself, accept who you are. But if I'm not competitive in all aspects of my life, I'm failing as an American, that I should be the greatest everything. And Liz, in our conversation, you know, she talked about being a 3-sport athlete and a musical theater person and clearly, you know, talented in many ways and just driven. And that is what we revere. And yet she's struggled with these kind of gut issues for a long time in her life. And the gut conversation continues to come up where there's whole fields, you know, areas of the mental health world that are focused on that gut mind connection, that there is this direct link between how our gut responds and feels to our emotional well-being, depression, anxiety, OCD, ADHD. And it's not just linked to nutrition, but it's how this second brain, that's what they call, you know, our intestinal system, our gut, the second brain responds to all of the stimulus that we're receiving. And so maybe that's, you know, I talked before about we have our set of values and then we have the way we're living our life. And if the two things don't mesh up, then that disconnect makes us ill, makes us anxious, makes us depressed, makes us angry, makes us petty, makes us lash out at other people and wish ill will on other people. I mean, because let's be honest, you know, it's one thing to say, I want to make sure that I surround myself by positive people. But as you said, I in turn then have to make sure I'm infusing other people with positive also.
Yeah. I think I'm striving to live my life at around a BB plus most of the time instead of just going for that solid 4.0 anymore, because I did that for a while and now I'm just trying to give myself a good 80-20 of 80% doing everything, and then, you know, if I try to eat, you know, live a happy, healthy, sexy life, but then, you know, 20% of the time you get to do, you know, something else that you want, or just cave or eat the ice cream or something like that.
But isn't it funny, because then it goes right back to like food choices as as the litmus test of our value and worth. And not what I would hope we say is, in the 80% of the time, I hope that I don't flip off the person that cuts me off. 80% of the time, I hope that I have something kind and loving to say. And then 20% of the time, I like fall prey to saying the petty thing or barking at my husband because, you know, I didn't eat my protein.
Yeah.
But it always seems to come back to how we treat our bodies. You know, I love this quote that says, you know, exercise is not punishment for what I ate, but a celebration of what my body can do.
I did like what she said about, you know, I'm not going to eat pasta, and then she yelled at her husband or something.
Yes. And that kind of goes back to the thing that, you know, in a lot of ways, we're so disconnected from our second brain or our emotional system, which is in our gut. And, you know, we talk about being hangry. And we laugh about that, but it's a true, honest thing that when you have lashing outs with your spouse or partner or people you care about, you know, that is a great check yourself. Have you had any food today? Have you had any protein today? How's your blood sugar? Because the majority of the time, you're not lashing out at them because they've actually done something that was wrong or bothered you. It's because your gut is out of whack.
That happened to me in the newsroom the other day. I just disappeared for a while. And they were like, where'd you go? And I said, I had to get food. And I said, and nobody can talk to me for about 5 minutes.
Until the food sets in.
Get back in.
Right. And then again, there's so many layers to this because we starve ourselves of food. We get in the habit of, I just won't eat at all. And then I will be of the body that I need to be. But that starvation, that deprivation leads to hangry episodes, low blood sugars, feeling dizzy, feeling out of sorts, feeling emotional. You know, a lot of people describe feeling weepy or emotional or overwrought, and it's because their blood sugar is all over the place because they're starving themselves because they want to live up to some ideal, you know, of what. But there is a something. It's not a zero, because I think when we talk about self-love, it's not self-acceptance to the point of laying on the couch and binge-watching shows and letting Doritos fall out of our mouth.
Which is super fun.
I don't know if I can allow myself that kind of freedom. But that is, you know, that's the other problem, is that we have to also define what is the difference between self-love and just loafing.
Yeah, well, that's why I said, going back to my 80-20 rules, if every once in a while, if I want to lay around and just sort of binge watch a show, whatever, you know, as long as I'm mostly keeping it together, I'm not going to beat myself up over that, you know?
And I wonder if that's more of a guy thing than a gal thing in culture, where, you know, because you don't experience you, not you, point your finger at you, Tyler, but as men in culture, that idea of becoming invisible isn't part of the story. You know, men become more wise and they become the gray fox and, you know, they have more wisdom. So they're that idea of letting that, you know, beer belly flow isn't as much of a struggle because you're just growing into your best self. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're kind of wandering through this topic of self-love and self-acceptance. And where do you stand on this? Are you fully engaged in love of yourself? Have you found that sweet spot of self-acceptance when you're not at war? Or are you someone that struggles with that? We have a couple more minutes left, and our number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. So let me talk a little bit about the difference between self-love and being self-indulgent. Yeah, too much indulgence in our self-image becomes self-absorbing, that we become a narcissist or we become too arrogant about who we are. So there is like this fine line between, you know, this constant affirmation, I'm just an awesome person, I'm in the gym, I'm eating perfectly, I'm so clean in everything I do every day, I exercise just this amount, I do functional medicine, I'm, you know, I have functional food, and this completely rigid way of being in the world becomes something that pushes other people out of your life. That in order to retain that level of indulgence in your self-image doesn't leave a lot of time for hanging out with your kids or having a conversation with your spouse or spending time with your friends. And there is actually this disorder called orthorexia, which is signified by being so obsessed with and so focused on your clean eating and your level of exercise and keeping your Fitbit and getting your 10,000 steps, being so obsessive with that lifestyle that you stop spending time with friends, or that your friends start kind of rejecting you, or you're not able to go out and have an evening with your friends or really enjoy kind of the simple pleasures in life because you have now narrowed your life down into this small package of behaviors that you live strictly by. You call it self-love, but it's almost like this self-imprisonment that orthorexia causes in people. And the other part of the orthorexia is there's a righteousness that is attached to it, this sense that I am better than everyone else because I live in such a clean and focused and organized and disciplined way that my behaviors now make me superior. I eat only organic. I drink only, filtered water. So orthorexia is a sense of self-indulgence and not just self-love. It becomes very metered and very constrained. The other thing that people worry about when it comes to self-love, is it going to cause me to become lazy? If I just accept who I am I just going to stop trying to be motivated or stop, achieving anything in life? And the answer is no, because laziness really isn't the equivalent of self-love. Laziness in some ways actually is a response to a sense of frustration, a cover-up for feeling kind of hopeless or having low self-esteem. There are times we have lazy days, as Tyler said. There are lazy days where we just want to hang out and put our feet up and just let it all go. We call it a caftan Sunday. But laziness is really, in a lot of ways, a signal that we're lacking in self-efficacy or self-confidence, that we become lazy by definition, not because we don't have the capacity for doing better for ourselves, but maybe we're lacking healthy emotional support, that we are surrounded by people that constantly kind of pick at us or undermine us. Are you going to eat that way? Can't you just have one fun night? Or, why are you always so hard on yourself? So that lacking of healthy emotional support can cause us to kind of give up on ourselves. Lacking self-discipline is not laziness, but it's also could be a sign that you're not really interested in that endeavor or task. And for a lot of people, if you spend a lifetime of being rigid and self-disciplined about everything, and you kind of let that self-discipline go in such a rigid way and try to find a balance, you can have the sense that you're kind of floating and out of control and not being responsive. But really there is this period of time when you drop the intensity of self-discipline to find this kind of balance where you might feel like you're not doing anything at all and that you're lazy, but you might actually just be taking good care of yourself. So this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our shows. Subscribe through Apple Podcasts or however you find your podcasts. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Check out our website or join us on Facebook or even on Instagram, EWBarrett_TRT. As always, I look forward to continuing this conversation. Thank you to Liz Beebe for being a part of the show, and I look forward to continuing on next week, Tuesday at 2. Thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.
When women wake, mountains move. When women wake, mountains move. When women rise, the world rises with us. So women wake, women wake, women rise, women rise, women rise. In a million small gestures, we weave it all together. Much of what we do goes unseen and unsung. But from our daily labors, our downright stubborn loving, a new world is begun. Women rise. can't ask for permission to change things. We may not even be nice.
When women wake, mountains move.
Grabbed your attention, a face or a story that won't let you go, each gesture you make in repairing this world will matter more than you'll ever know.